Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Inside American Education, The Decline, The Deception, The Dogmas, by Thomas Sowell. Narrated by Malcolm Hilgartner. For the first time in the history of our country, the educational skills of one generation will not surpass, will not equal, will not even approach those of their parents. John Copperman. Preface. Like many other people, I have long been appalled by the low quality and continuing deterioration of American education. However, after doing the research for this book, I'm frankly surprised that the results are not even worse than they are. The incredibly counterproductive fads, fashions, and dogmas of American education, from the kindergarten to the colleges, have yet to take their full toll, in part because all the standards of earlier times have not yet been completely eroded away. But the inevitable retirement of an older generation of teachers and professors must leave the new trends, and their accompanying newspeak, as the dominant influence on the shaping of education in the generations to come. Much has been said about how our young people do not meet the academic standards of their peers in other countries with which we compete economically. While this is both true and important, their academic deficiencies are only half the story. All across this country, the school curriculum has been invaded by psychological conditioning programs, which not only take up time sorely needed for intellectual development, but also promote an emotionalized and anti-intellectual way of responding to the challenges facing every individual and every society. Worst of all, the psychotherapeutic curriculum systematically undermines the parent-child relationship and the shared values which make a society possible. Parents who send their children to school with instructions to respect and obey their teachers may be surprised to discover how often these children are sent back home, conditioned to disrespect and disobey their parents. While psychological conditioning programs may not succeed in producing the atomistic society, or the self-sufficient and morally isolated individual which seems to be their ideal, they may nevertheless confuse children who receive very different moral and social messages from school and home. In short, too many American schools are turning out students who are not only intellectually incompetent, but also morally confused, emotionally alienated, and socially maladjusted. At the college and university level, the intrusion of non-intellectual and anti-intellectual material into the curriculum takes more of an ideological rather than a psychological form. New courses, new departments, and whole new programs concentrate on leading students to preconceived ideological conclusions, rather than developing the student's ability to analyze issues so as to reach independent conclusions. The particular subject matter of these ideological courses and programs may range from race to the environment or foreign policy, but the general approach is the same, not only in its fundamental anti-intellectualism, but also in its underlying hostility to American society and Western civilization, and the tendentiousness, or even dishonesty, with which it attempts to indoctrinate. Here again, the danger is not that these methods will succeed in achieving their goals, but that they will undermine or cripple education in the attempt. Thomas Sowell, Hoover Institution. Chapter 1. Decline, Deception, and Dogmas. Virtually everyone has heard how poorly American students perform, whether compared to foreign students or to American students of a generation ago. What everyone may not know are the specifics of how bad the situation has become, how and why the public has been deceived, or the dogmas and hidden agendas behind it all. The general decline in educational performance that began in the 1960s encompassed elementary and secondary education, as well as education at the college level. The evidences of this decline include not only results on a variety of objective tests, but also first-hand observations by teachers and professors, and dismaying experiences by employers who have found the end product seriously lacking. The most widely known decline was in the scores on the Scholastic Aptitude Test, SAT. However, scores also declined on the rival American College Testing Program, ACT examination, as well as on the Iowa Test of Educational Development, and on a variety of local tests. As of 1991, only 11% of the 8th grade students in California's public schools could solve 7th grade math problems. Significantly, this era of declining academic performance has also been a period of rising grades. American high schools gave out approximately twice as many C's as A's in 1966, but by 1978, the A's actually exceeded the C's. By 1990, more than one-fifth of all entering freshmen in college averaged A-minus or above for their entire high school careers. At private universities, entering freshmen with averages of A-minus or above were an absolute majority, 54%. Similar grade inflation has become common at the college level. Between 1958 and 1988, the average grade at Dartmouth rose from C to B. More specifically, the Dartmouth student body's grade point average rose from 2.2 in 1958 to 3.2 in 1988. At the University of Chicago, the once common grade of C constituted only 15% of all grades by 1988. Yet Chicago's grades are considered comparatively low relative to grades at comparable institutions around the country. At Yale, for example, the proportion of grades that were A's never fell below 40% during the entire decade of the 1980s. At Smith College, likewise, A's were 40% of all grades by the end of the 1980s, a tripling of the proportion of A's over a period of 25 years, and A's and B's combined constituted more than 90% of all grades. Rare is the college like Franklin and Marshall, where the student body's grade point average has remained consistently below B over the years. Among the factors behind nationwide rises in college grades, in addition to more lenient grading by professors, have been such widespread practices as not recording failing grades on the students' records, allowing students to withdraw from class when a failing grade is impending, and ordinary cheating. Between 1966 and 1988, the proportion of students cheating increased by 78%, according to a national survey. These two trends, grade inflation and declining test scores, are by no means unconnected. Without the systematic deception of parents and the public by rising grades, it is highly unlikely that the decline in performance could have continued so long. The deeper question is, why? Whose purposes are being served, and whose agendas are being advanced as American education declines? Performance and deception. Perhaps nothing so captures what is wrong with American schools as the results of an international study of 13-year-olds, which found that Koreans ranked first in mathematics and Americans last. When asked if they thought they were good at mathematics, only 23% of the Korean youngsters said yes, compared to 68% of American 13-year-olds. The American educational dogma that students should feel good about themselves was a success in its own terms, though not in any other terms. A related educational dogma is that learning must be enjoyable to be effective. However, another international study found that a higher percentage of Japanese 12th graders disliked mathematics than did their American counterparts, but the Japanese did much better on mathematics tests. When nearly one-third of American 17-year-olds do not know that Abraham Lincoln wrote the Emancipation Proclamation, when nearly half do not know who Joseph Stalin was, and when about 30% could not locate Britain on a map of Europe, then it is clear that American educational deficiencies extend far beyond mathematics. As for trends over time, perhaps the best known and most revealing statistic is that scores on the Scholastic Aptitude Test, SAT, taken by high school seniors applying for college admissions, began declining in the early 1960s and did not begin to rise again until the early 1980s. This decline was gradual but steady, falling from a composite verbal and quantitative score of 980 in 1963 to 890 in 1980 and 1981. Despite a small upturn, the average SAT score has never returned to the level it reached more than a quarter of a century ago. As of 1990, the average combined verbal math SAT score was 900, 10 points above the low of 1980, but still 80 points below the high of 1963. As of 1991, the average verbal SAT score dropped to an all-time low. Even these data do not capture the full story of educational disaster in American public schools. Members of the educational establishment often try to downplay such evidence by dismissing the importance of mere facts acquired by rote memory. Unfortunately, as we turn from simple knowledge to more complex abilities in reasoning, the full debacle of American education becomes even more painfully clear. An international study of 13-year-olds showed that American youngsters fell further and further behind the more they were required to think. When given science questions on everyday facts, American youngsters did almost as well as Korean youngsters, answering correctly 96% of the time, as compared to 100% among the Koreans. But when required to apply simple principles, a significant gap opened up, as Koreans answered correctly 93% of the time, and Americans only 78% of the time. Going on to a higher level, requiring students to analyze experiments, Korean youngsters answered correctly 73% of the time, while Americans answered correctly only 42% of the time. At a still higher level of analysis, where only 33% of Korean students could answer correctly, only 12% of Americans could answer correctly. In short, while American youngsters could pretty much hold their own at the level of simple facts, the advantage shifted decisively in favor of the Korean youngsters when thinking was involved, becoming more than a 2-to-1 advantage when more sophisticated levels of reasoning were reached. Science is not the only field in which American students are lacking in knowledge and, more importantly, in the ability to tie what they know together to form a coherent chain of reasoning. Many American students seem unaware of even the need for such a process. Test scores are only the tip of the iceberg. Professor Diane Ravitch, a scholar specializing in the study of American education, reports that professors complain about students who arrive at college with strong convictions, but not enough knowledge to argue persuasively for their beliefs. As Professor Ravitch concludes, having opinions without knowledge is not of much value. Not knowing the difference between them is a positive indicator of ignorance. In short, it is not merely that Johnny can't read, or even that Johnny can't think. Johnny doesn't know what thinking is, because thinking is so often confused with feeling in many public schools. Psychotherapeutic education. The phrase, "I feel," is often used by American students to introduce a conclusion, rather than say, "I think," or "I know," much less, "I conclude." Unfortunately, "I feel" is often the most accurate term, and is regarded as sufficient by many teachers as well as students. The net result, as in mathematics, is that many students are confident in competence, whether discussing social issues, world events, or other subjects. The emphasis is on having students express opinions on issues and on having those opinions taken seriously, enhancing self-esteem, regardless of whether there is anything behind them. When a reporter who spent months in a Los Angeles high school asked graduating seniors what they had learned, he received this reply from a boy described as the smartest student in the class. "I learned that in the Vietnam War, North and South Korea fought against each other, and then there was a truce at the 38th parallel, and that Eisenhower had something to do with it." The reporter asked, "Would it bother you to know that the things you learned were wrong?" The answer was, "Not really, because what we really learned from Miss Silver was that we were worth listening to, that we could express ourselves, and that an adult would listen, even if we were wrong. That's why Miss Silver will always be our favorite teacher. She made us feel like we mattered, like we were important." The teacher herself saw her role in very similar terms. I want to be real in class and be a human being, and I want my students to know that they can be themselves and I'll still listen to them. I want every one of them to have a chance to express himself or herself. Those are my priorities. Neither this teacher nor this school was unique. A large literature has urged teachers to be non-judgmental, to humanize the classroom, to raise the self-esteem of students. A leading writer on such matters, the late psychotherapist Carl Rogers, spoke of helping students to prize themselves, to build their confidence and self-esteem, of teachers who are real persons and who humanize their classrooms. It was assumed that intellectual development would be part of this process. The Los Angeles reporter's observation, however, was that the students he saw know little in the way of organized thought processes or even basic ways of solving intellectual problems. While the reporter noted the sincerity or intensity of the teachers, he nevertheless concluded, "A human being who has not been taught to think clearly is a danger in a free society." Too many American students learn neither an intellectual process nor a knowledge base, nor acquire habits of study. Writer Mary McCarthy, after a stint on campus as a visiting professor, said that today's college students seemed almost totally ignorant of the whole period spanned by my life, to say nothing of what happened before. More generally, a Carnegie Foundation survey of faculty members found that 67% of the professors reported a widespread lowering of standards in American higher education. 75% characterized their students as seriously underprepared in basic skills, and 62% reported grade inflation as a problem at their colleges. Moreover, 55% said that undergraduates at their institution only do enough to get by. Just how little that is may be indicated by the fact that only 33% of college students put in 16 or more hours of study per week outside of class in 1985, and this declined to 23% by 1988. As of 1966, 52% of all college freshmen had checked at least one book out of a library during the preceding year. By 1990, only 27% had done so. Educators and parents are not the only ones dissatisfied with the kinds of students American schools are turning out. A survey of Fortune 500 companies showed that 58% complained of the difficulty of finding employees with basic skills. The chief executive officer of Pacific Telesis reported, "Only 4 out of every 10 candidates for entry-level jobs at Pacific Telesis are able to pass our entry exams, which are based on a 7th-grade level." In 1989, New York Life began airlifting its health insurance claims to Ireland for processing, because American workers made too many mistakes. Changes over time. One of the reasons why basics are not learned is that they are not taught, at least not at the same level or with the same emphasis as in the past. For example, the process of making public school textbooks easier to read has been going on so long and so widely that it has even acquired a well-known generic name, dumbing down. For example, when a well-known history book was revised with an eye toward the high school market, words like spectacle and admired were eliminated as difficult. Some idea of how far this deliberate erosion of standards has gone may be gotten from looking at the once standard McGuffey's readers from generations ago, or by looking at examinations from that bygone era. McGuffey's first reader, for example, included diacritical marks to indicate the pronunciation of vowels and the emphasis of syllables. McGuffey's third reader contained such words as heath and benighted, and asked such questions as, "What is this species of composition called?" and "Relate the facts of this dialogue." McGuffey's fourth reader included selections from Longfellow and Hawthorne, and the fifth reader from Shakespeare. These were not the textbooks of the elite, but of the masses. For the better part of a century, from 1836 to 1920, McGuffey's readers were so widely used that they sold more than 122 million copies, second in sales only to the Bible. In the early years of the 20th century, pupils finishing the 8th grade in Kansas had to pass an examination which included spelling such words as elucidation and animosity, defining such terms as zenith and panegyric, as well as diagramming sentences and doing such problems in arithmetic as finding the interest earned on a $900 note at 8% after 2 years, 2 months, and 6 days. Questions of similar difficulty were asked in geography and history, all in order to get a diploma awarded at the end of the 8th grade. These were not elite prep schools. Often they were one-room schoolhouses in rural Kansas. Excuses for failure. The responses of the educational establishment to the academic deficiencies of their students today include 1. Secrecy, 2. Camouflage, 3. Denial, 4. Shifting the blame elsewhere, and 5. Demanding more money. Confidentiality policies maintain secrecy, while inflated grades and a policy of not recording failing grades help many institutions to camouflage the facts, so that optimistic public statements can effectively deny what is happening. When the facts become so blatant as to overwhelm these defenses, the strategy is simply to shift the blame to some other factor, outside the educational system. These include both social factors and financial resources. Social factors. Although educators have been quick to blame the failures of the schools on factors outside the schools, there has been remarkably little critical examination of these claims. It is unquestionably true that the home backgrounds of children influence how well they do in school, and that these backgrounds vary by social class and by race. However, to say that an influence exists is not to say that it explains the particular pattern that we see. Many have tried to use the changing social mixture of students in American schools and colleges as an explanation of declining test scores. American Federation of Teachers President Albert Shanker used this tactic during a 1986 debate at the University of California at Davis. During the period of falling SAT scores, Shanker said, schools had discouraged students from dropping out, thereby retaining more difficult youngsters, whose scores presumably lowered the average. In reality, however, SAT scores declined at the top, not because there were more low scores averaged in. More than 116,000 students scored above 600 on the verbal SAT in 1972, and fewer than 71,000 scored that high 10 years later. Between the early 1960s and the early 1980s, median SAT scores dropped at colleges from coast to coast, including the most prestigious institutions. Both verbal and quantitative SAT scores declined at Yale, Princeton, Caltech, the University of Chicago, Oberlin, Rice, Brandeis, Carleton, Pomona, Reed, Whitman, and Davidson, for example. The composite score decline was more than 100 points at Brandeis and Reed. As Diane Ravitch put it, the shrinkage of the top scorers has proceeded steadily since the 1960s and obviously is unrelated to the overall composition of the test group. Obviously, except to the educational establishment. The false argument that retaining a higher proportion of low-performance students accounts of low average scores is also used to excuse the dismal performance of American students in international comparisons. But virtually all 13-year-olds are in school in all the countries surveyed in international mathematics performance surveys. While some countries have a smaller proportion of their students remain in school to reach the last year of high school than the United States does, Japan has an even higher proportion staying in school to finish than the U.S. does. So selectivity can hardly explain the superior performance of the Japanese. Carnegie Foundation President Ernest L. Boyer has claimed that for a small percentage of students at the top, the American high school provides an outstanding education, perhaps the finest in the world. However, this wholly unsubstantiated statement is contradicted by the results of international tests. The top 5% of American high school seniors scored last on algebra and calculus tests administered to the top 5% of 12th graders from a dozen countries. While it is undoubtedly true that there are many negative factors at work in many low-income neighborhood schools, especially those in the inner-city ghettos and barrios. That does not automatically explain away the declining academic performances of American schools in general. Black and Hispanic students have lower-than-average test scores on such examinations as the Scholastic Aptitude Test, but their SAT scores cannot explain the national decline, for Hispanic scores have risen during much of the national decline, and black scores have risen still more. Even in low-income, crime-ridden neighborhoods, Catholic and other private schools have often produced far better academic results than the public schools in the same areas. The public schools' usual attempts to escape comparisons by claiming that Catholic and other private schools have children from higher-income, better-educated families will not work in these particular cases. A Rand Corporation study not only confined its sample of Catholic schools to those in low-income ghetto and barrio neighborhoods in New York, but also included youngsters whose parents did not pay to send them to Catholic schools, but whose tuition there was paid by private individuals who wanted to enable an unselected sample of public school children to attend Catholic schools, to see if these unselected youngsters would also do better than those remaining in the public schools. The youngsters who transferred into the Catholic schools did significantly better than their peers who remained in the public schools, even though these transferees from the public school came mostly from single-parent households on welfare and entered the Catholic schools 2 or more years behind on placement tests. For that matter, some special public schools located in poor neighborhoods also did much better than most other public schools. In short, better schools produce demonstrably better results, even in the worst neighborhoods. The serious social problems of many inner-city youngsters cannot explain the downward trend of American education in general, nor even fully explain the educational catastrophes in bad neighborhoods. The fervor with which various social problems are seized upon as explanations of American educational deficiencies is not based on any evidence that will stand up under scrutiny. These explanations are only a symptom of the desperate necessity of shoring up the dogma that educational failures could not possibly be the fault of the public school system. Financial factors. When all else fails, spokesmen and apologists for the education establishment blame a lack of money, often expressed as a lack of commitment by the public or the government, for their problems. The issue is posed as how serious the public or its political leaders are about investing in the education of the next generation. This cleverly turns the tables on critics and loads guilt onto the taxpaying public for the failures of American schools and colleges. Implicit in all this is the wholly unsupported assumption that more money means better education. Neither comparisons among states, comparisons over time, nor international comparisons lend any credence to this arbitrary and self-serving assumption. States that spend more per pupil in the public schools do not generally have any better educational performance to show for it. The correlation between financial inputs and educational outputs is very weak and shaky. Connecticut, for example, spent more than $4,000 per pupil in 1984, but student test scores were lower than those in Vermont, which spent just under $3,000 per pupil. Rhode Island also spent close to $4,000 per pupil and had the lowest average SAT scores of the three. New York State spent more than $5,000 per pupil that year, finished just barely ahead of Rhode Island and significantly behind Vermont. One could cite other cases where the more expensively educated students did better, but overall, there is no real evidence to support the claim that more money means better educational quality. More affluent communities are typically better educated communities, where parents emphasize education to their children, and may be more willing and able to put more money into the local schools. But it is by no means clear that whatever better educational results come out of this combination of circumstances is due to the money. A highly respected Brookings Institution study concluded, "When other relevant factors are taken into account, economic resources are unrelated to student achievement." One reason why spending has so little effect on educational performance is that most of the money never reaches the classroom. Studies of the Milwaukee and New York City school systems show that less than half the money spent per high school student in New York.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?